Your Steve Jones Show podcast is loading now. The Steve Jones Show podcast is sponsored by Purdy Insurance. Visit Purdy Insurance on Market Street in Sunbury or visit online at purdyinsurance.com. Sports talk where your voice counts. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motor Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Great to be back. And today's show brought to you by Purdy Insurance, Market Street in Sunbury. Go to purdyinsurance.com. The Purdy's have just served this valley for decades now. They've always been able to find the best insurance for your needs at the right cost that fits your budget. And if there's a claim, you cannot ask for a better partner. They will attack it with everything that they have because they know the partnership is so important between you and them. You need to have a great relationship with your insurance agent and your insurance agency. Can't ask for a better one than Purdy Insurance. Market Street in Sunbury. Go to purdyinsurance.com. I'm in the Sunbury Motors studio. Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury. Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Matt Leon coming up in just a few moments. We'll talk about Philadelphia sports. The trade deadline came and went yesterday in Major League Baseball. Howie Kendrick and of course, previously Jeremy Hellickson both gone now for the Philadelphia Phillies, and it's just a question of restocking along the way. The big trades were made yesterday by mostly the Dodgers and the Yankees, as the Dodgers picked up Yu Darvish from the Texas Rangers, and they also picked up Tony Watson from the Pittsburgh Pirates, and left-handed reliever Tony Cingrani from the Cincinnati Reds. The Dodgers only had two capable left-handed relievers in their bullpen. Now by getting Cingrani and also Watson, they've fortified that side. They get a starting pitcher, Yu Darvish, which fills the void with Clayton Kershaw currently out. And then all of a sudden you now combine Kershaw with a guy like Darvish for the postseason. You're feeling pretty good about where you're going. The Yankees got Sonny Gray yesterday from the Oakland A's. And they also picked up Garcia from the Minnesota Twins, which was interesting because the Twins had just picked up Garcia from the Atlanta Braves. So they've been able to fortify their starting rotation with Jaime Garcia and Sonny Gray, giving up minor league prospects. Howie Kendrick to the Nationals. They get Mackenzie Mills. Saw Mills pitch with Auburn last year. Good prospect. Good prospects on pitch with Auburn last year. Hellickson, of course, they acquired Hyun-Soo Kim, Garrett Clevenger, and, of course, the ever-valuable international bonus pool money, which is extremely valuable when you pass go and collect $200. The Orioles also got infielder Tim Beckham for Tobias Myers from the Tampa Bay Rays. The Yankees, of course, picked up Sonny Gray. They picked up Jaime Garcia. In combination with what they already did, the Red Sox picked up Addison Reed from the Mets. They need a setup guy. They know they need a setup guy along the way because Joe Kelly, who had not given up a run in 2.5 months, had to go on the disabled list. They also picked up Eduardo Nunez, who's off to a great start with them. So those are some of the deals that were made. The big difference between this and what you can do this month is that you didn't need waivers yesterday. You'll need waivers to complete trades before the end of this month. So you have to clear waivers in order to be eligible to be dealt. And August 31st is critical because if you're dealt before August 31st, you are then eligible for postseason play. That's the other critical part. The Pirates picked up Joaquin Benoit from the Phillies. He's now the Pirates' problem. We'll come back, Matt Leon, in a moment as we continue on News Radio 1070 WKOK, brought to you by Purdy Insurance. All All right, let's tap into some Philadelphia sports brought to you by our good friends at Purdy Insurance, Market Street in Sunbury. Go to purdyinsurance.com. Matt Leon joins us from KYW in Philadelphia. Kind sir, welcome back. It is great to hear you on the other end.
Great to be with you.
So here we are, trade deadline. Phillies have already made some moves, but we'll start with this, then we'll get to the other stuff. Just an overview of where they are, in your opinion.
I think they, I don't want to say turn the corner, because they're still the worst team in baseball record-wise. Yeah. But what you've seen the last couple of weeks is a much more competitive, I think much more what we thought we were going to see for the most part this year, a team that, you know, for the last few weeks, just about every night gets a solid starting pitching effort. Nothing dominant by no means, but every time you look up, sixth, seventh inning, they've only given up 2-3 runs. Offense has improved significantly since the beginning of the season, and the bullpen has been pretty good. Okay, you know, not the disaster it was the first few months, but not as good as I thought it was going to be overall. But it's been much more enjoyable to watch, not just because of the wins and losses, but they're just playing much cleaner, crisper games here as of late.
Yeah. And the Hellickson situation, I mean, do you think that worked out for the best here?
I think they, you know, I think it worked for everybody that they got solid performances every fifth day from Hellickson while he was here. He wasn't as good this year, specifically the last couple of months, as he was last year and April of this year. But, you know, they were able to turn him around. They get the veteran outfielder in Kim, who I don't think is long for here. He's a free agent. And they get a pretty good prospect that they can throw into this system and see what happens. It also opens up a rotation spot for Jake Thompson, so you could see what he can do here, getting the ball every fifth day. These trades, all these trades that they made for the most part here, were important for what you get back, because you get young talent back, but it was more important for creating spots for younger guys that were ready to go, and I think that's that was really the big key with a lot of these deals.
All right, let's get to the Eagles. Going into camp, and give me an idea, in this four-team division, where you think they have some strengths as opposed to other teams in the division?
I think they're good at quarterback. I think I expect Carson Wentz, as nice of a rookie year as he had, I expect him to take a really big step this year. And for no other reason, just he's got better talent to throw to this season.
And he also understands the game speed of it now completely compared to a year ago.
Yeah, no question about it. And they've done a nice job of assembling talent where he doesn't have to carry the thing. You know, he's got legitimate playmakers at the wide receiver position now. And all of a sudden, you look at a Jordan Matthews, who was miscast as a number one. Now you look at him as a slot receiver, and he's a lot more attractive. Like Aaron Blunt in the backfield, you know, a guy you can lean on in the running game. I think they're in a good spot. I mean, still some questions. I think the linebackers on defense and the cornerbacks on defense. Linebacker, I want to see some depth. Cornerback, you've kind of got to see some guys emerge, and they're probably taking a wing and a prayer with some young guys, hoping that they come through. But I think they're a better team than last year. I think they're a deeper team than last year. I think the arrow's pointing up.
I think the arrow's definitely pointing up as well. The fact that Peterson's back for his second year, what are a couple of areas where, you know, where when he looks at himself in the mirror, where he knows he needs to be, where he's really solid in a lot of areas, but where does he need to be a little bit better?
Last year, his play calling was uneven. I thought one of the impressive things when they got off to that 3-0 start was he really seemed locked in play calling. I thought it was versatile. I thought it was unconventional, but it wasn't crazy. And then he really seemed to kind of get off the rails, conversely, when they struggled in the middle of the season, where I thought he got predictable and maybe gambled at the wrong times. And I would like to see, I think that'll be big here in year two. I'd like to see, with a whole year under his belt and the second year with Wentz, I'd like to see some more consistency in the play calling and understanding your options around you. And I think just like with anything else, the second year, everything slows down for you. You've been through training camp once. Yeah. You've been through the OTAs once. You just know how to handle things. handle things better. I think he's got a pretty good handle on the locker room at this point. I don't have any real concerns there. But the play calling for me will be a big thing going into this season.
Which rookies go into this camp that you are going to keep a closer eye on because they intrigue you?
I mean, Derek Barnett, the number one pick, the first round pick, yeah. I think you hear great things about his work ethic coming out of the first week of training camp here. Obviously, at any first round pick, you're going to keep an eye on Rasul Douglas, the cornerback from West Virginia.
Yeah.
Lanky, ball hawk, and as a quarterback, he's a kid that is playing a position they desperately need someone to step up in. So I think he's a guy that could, if he performs well, and you've seen signs in training camp that people have seen what they saw when he was at West Virginia, he could be a key guy on defense because it could be a situation of the right player playing the right position at the right time.
Right. Player or two that has the ability to make the next step, who would that be?
That's a good question. You could probably, I feel like every year for the last, whatever it is, 4 years, we've written Zach Ertz's name in that line.
Yes.
As the guy, the tight end, the guy who's ready to break through. And every year, Ertz really struggles the first half of the season. And then it kind of seems like when people stop paying attention, he becomes what everybody thought he could be that year. I mean, you would hope with Alshon Jeffery, Torrey Smith, with all the weapons around, he's going to have a lot of room to roam underneath, that maybe he could finally break through and have that consistent high-level season that people have been waiting for. Past that, that's a really good question. You know who is, and I don't know if it's the next step, but when you talk about a guy who wasn't here, Timmy Jernigan, the
yes.
defensive tackle
yep.
they got from Baltimore, playing next to Fletcher Cox, he could create all kinds of nonsense in the middle of the line, and he could also make life a lot easier for Fletcher Cox. He's not a name you hear a lot of because he wasn't, you know, a new draft pick, and a lot of times with interior linemen, it's hard to feel their impact. But that's a guy to keep an eye on, I think, that could really have a big take a big step on the defensive line.
Now let's go to the opposite side. Who is in the get it done now or you're done now category?
Nelson Agholor,
yeah.
The first-round pick from a few years ago, who has been a disappointment, to say the least, struggles with confidence. You've gotten good reports here, and I think this could be a big year if this makes sense. As a number one pick, there is a spotlight on you, and he struggled under the heat of that spotlight. Frankly, no one expects anything from Nelson Agholor at this point,
yeah.
And I think he will stick around because it makes more financial sense to keep him than it does to cut him. And if all of a sudden the talent is there, and you see it every once in a while, and it's subtle things like the way he catches the ball, the way he breaks out of a pattern, stuff like that. If he could harness that and nobody's paying any attention to him here and anything he does will be gravy as a number four, number five receiver, all of a sudden maybe he can build up that confidence where it becomes second nature and maybe he could force himself back into the conversation as a long-term option. But any kind of struggles or anything, and I think that will be it for Nelson Agholor.
We know that Chris Borland in 2015, after one season in the NFL, said, I'm really worried about CTE, and he quit. And of course, John Urschel, who is as intelligent as anybody I've ever talked to in my lifetime, thoughtful, he decided to quit. And I know how much John loved football. John did not just do football because I'm big, strong, and I'm quick, and I can play. John loved playing football. Have you talked to any of the Eagles about any of this at all since it has become, when the study came out about the 99 out of 100?
No, I have not. I have not been down there for any of that, but I think it's a concern. I think this is, I don't know how you attack this or how you handle this if you're the NFL.
Yeah.
Because it is kind of a fundamental. And if you look at all the things they've tried to do in recent years to try to eliminate some contact, and it's almost like a square peg in a round hole. People love football because of the physicality. If you try to police the physicality, it's not quite the same game.
Right,
and
exactly.
People don't like it as much. So it's a conundrum that I don't know what the answer is. I really don't, because you see with all the stuff they've tried to do with fining guys for hitting with their helmet down, and then you can't legislate violence. You know, you can't say, you know, this is okay to this point, but anything past that, no, that's really hard to do. And what you end up getting is everybody interpreting everything their own way and no consistency, and then guys don't know what they can and can't do, and it's just a degradation of the process and of the quality of play. So I don't know what the answer is here, and I think if it was an easy one, somebody would have figured it out by now.
Now, you announced Penn along the way, and the Ivy League does not do hitting during the week. The one time you're allowed to hit, I'm talking, you know, like a scrimmage, things like that. I mean, you can do pass thuds and things like that where you wrap and catch and release, and you can play tag off and things like that. How did the Penn coaches feel about the only time you hit during the week is during the game? Did that work out well for them?
I think you learn to deal with it, and you learn to adjust. It is a veteran coaching staff at Penn, guys that just haven't been there for a long time, but they have been coaching for a long time.
Right.
They learn to adjust. These are the rules. This is what you're allowed to do, what you're not allowed to do, you know, and you do it to the best of your ability. They want a piece of the Ivy League title for a second straight year. So it worked. I think it helps in the Ivy League, as you mentioned, that everybody's under the same rule.
Right, exactly. Yeah, Dartmouth started this, but then now everybody does it.
Yeah, so it makes it easier to deal with, as opposed to like one or two schools being forced to do one thing and then trying to compete with everybody else who the rules aren't quite as stringent. But this is the great question for football. It's going to be really fascinating to see what the sport is in 15, 20 years. Well, because I think what you're going to see, if this is when this is really going to start to affect, is when, you know, parents stop their kids playing football when they're younger, and all of a sudden that feeder system, maybe it doesn't dry up, but all of a sudden the talent level isn't the same, and the ripple effect will be felt far and wide. And you know, once again, I don't know what the answer is, and I don't know if there is one. Yeah. I don't know if there is a good one.
I think if there's an answer out there, the reason that you and I can't talk about answers and that we don't have any is there isn't an answer right now.
Yeah.
I think what you're seeing now with younger people is you're wondering, there's a couple sports, for example. Football's one of them. How many are going to keep putting their youngsters into youth football? Drew Brees, for example, is doing something where they're essentially doing a lot of 7-on-7 stuff. He coaches this, and it's a flag football system. He thinks that players should not be playing until they actually get to high school, which I find that interesting. I'll tell you another one, too, is starting to suffer a little bit is wrestling on the youth level. There's not, you know, there, you know, you go to a youth wrestling thing, there's a lot of forfeits and walkovers.
Yeah.
It seems like soccer is the one that's thriving, and yet you'll find that heading a soccer ball also leads to concussions. So I don't know.
It's going to be interesting, and the reason I think a lot of it feels so haphazard now is we're trying to play catch-up for the last 40 years in a lot of situations. So you've got a lot of, for lack of a better term, flailing one direction or another, because for a lot of times people just wanted to look the other way and pretend this wasn't a problem or didn't understand it. And not necessarily, I don't want to put a nefarious slant on it, but didn't quite get it. But, you know, it's the fundamental question of really for football going forward.
Yeah, no, it's interesting because you're talking about the last 20 years. That's where the research into it really took off. When we first heard, for example, Matt, that you are 50% more susceptible to a second concussion as opposed. I mean, these are all things we didn't know 25, 30 years ago.
Oh, yeah. Now, and you talk to a lot of players who played in the 60s, 70s. You know, they're convinced they had, you know, two dozen concussions, but it was just, you know, you sat out a few plays, well, everything settled down, and then you got back out there, and it was just universally accepted that way.
Yeah. Matt, always a pleasure. Great to have you back.
Thank you so much, sir. Take care.
Matt Leon, KYW in Philadelphia. We're headed to the bottom of the hour. News coming up here on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Kurt Badenhausen will join us from Forbes in the next half hour. Talk a little bit about the business of sports. Yes. I get to hang on the air intellectually with a guy from Forbes.
Yep. It's like me playing golf against Jordan Spieth.
All right. They're both swinging clubs. The ball's going in different directions. All right, bottom of the hour. News is next here on News Radio 1070 WKOK, brought to you by Purdy Insurance.
Taking your calls at 800-795-9565. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motor Studio, here's Steve Jones.
And today's show brought to you by Purdy Insurance, Market Street in Sunbury. Go to PurdyInsurance.com. Purdy's have served the Valley and have served you, their customers, for decades. Why is it they have people that a long list that they've served for decades? Because everybody knows that Purdy Insurance is the best to deal with. They'll find you the right insurance, right price. And not only that, there's a claim they'll jump right in because customer service means everything. They're personable, knowledgeable, and they get the job done. Purdy Insurance, Market Street in Sunbury. Go to PurdyInsurance.com. I'm in the Sunbury Motors studio. Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury. Sunbury Motors, Kia Routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Kurt Badenhausen from Forbes coming up in a few moments. First, this day in sports history. In 1945, Mel Ott hit his 500th career home run. In 1972, Joe Namath signed a two-year contract worth $500,000 with the New York Jets. 1976, the curtain came up on the Seattle Seahawks. Their first ever preseason game, they lost to the 49ers 27-20. 1978, Pete Rose of the Reds had his 44-game hitting streak ended. Gene Garber struck him out in the ninth inning. Rose complained after the game, "They gave me nothing to hit." Now that's whining, moaning, and complaining. Also in this date, 1986, Burt Blyleven became only the 10th pitcher to strike out 3,000 batters in a career. And in 1993, Reggie Jackson was admitted into baseball's Hall of Fame in Cooperstown. And that is this day in sports history. All right. On this show, we bring on a lot of great guests. Every once in a while, we'll have to talk with somebody with an Ivy League background. Now we're going to talk to someone from Forbes. Hey, for the next 15 minutes or so, I will attempt to hang in this conversation with Kurt Badenhausen from Forbes. Kurt, welcome. It's great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me on, Steve. I'm just a sports guy, too, so no worries.
Way to ease it in with me. Very nice. A couple things I noticed right away. I'll start with this. The impact of the NFL, in which you had 29 of the 51, because the Angels and the Saints are tied for 50. 29 of the 51 are NFL teams. When I see the Jacksonville Jaguars worth $1.95 billion and up 32%, that to me makes a big statement.
Yeah, it doesn't matter whether you're in Jacksonville or Chicago or Philadelphia, no matter where you are. If you own an NFL team, you got a good thing going on. You're guaranteed to make money. And owning one of those 32 NFL franchises, it's a road to profitability and incredibly high-profile gig. You know, it's not like owning a small market Major League Baseball team or something. Just being in that NFL club is a big deal. These teams almost never come on the market. So when they do, people are beating down the door to get into the NFL club. And with that national TV deal, $7 billion these guys are chopping up every single year before they sell a ticket, a beer, or a jersey. So every team, by our count, made more than $25 million in profit for the 2015 season. And those TV deals are locked in into the next decade. The CBA right now, you know, guarantees the players less than 50% of gross revenue. So good time to be an NFL owner, that's for sure.
No, absolutely no doubt about that. I think the Bengals, the Lions, and the Bills were the only three that didn't make the top 51.
And finished just outside the top 50. I don't think you could get an NFL team for less than probably $1.7-1.8 billion right now, and that includes those real small markets.
You also have international soccer in here among the most valuable in the world. This, again, is on pure value. Yet what I found interesting, it's only slight, but Real Madrid went down 2%. Arsenal went down 4%. What accounted for that?
That's really a function of the weakness of the euro, the weakness of the British pound. Both of those currencies have really been hammered versus the U.S. dollar over the last 12 months. Great Britain voted to remove itself from the European Union, which killed the British pound. And so that, so from, if you looked at it in their local currencies, whether euros for the Spanish clubs or British pounds for the teams in England, they're up. But if you translate it into U.S. dollars, those clubs took a hit over the last 12 months.
In fact, I believe after Brexit, the euro got as low as, I think, $1.02, $1.03, and I think the pound got as low as, what, $1.14? Does that sound right?
Yeah. No, absolutely. It's gone up a little bit since then.
Right.
But, you know, the dollar is so much stronger compared to those currencies these days. So that's what really hurt those clubs. But they're killing it, too. I mean, particularly the Premier League clubs, very similar to the NFL, massive television package that really helps all those Premier League teams.
Yeah, between Sky Sports and then, of course, what they were able to negotiate over here with NBC Sports and Fox, it's really paid off for them.
Yeah, Premier League is absolutely hot right now. And what's incredible about these clubs, particularly the top-tier clubs, is Real Madrid or Manchester United or Barcelona, they can go into basically every part of the world and do a sponsorship deal. You know, you can't do that. A baseball team can't do that. A football team, a national football league team can't do that. But these soccer clubs, they do deals all over the world because they have such a huge following just about every part of the globe. And so sponsorship revenue, merchandise revenue for these teams play a much bigger part in the overall revenue stream than what you might have with, say, a baseball team in the United States or a team in the NFL.
Kurt, I'm glad you brought that part up because I want to talk about the Dallas Cowboys. I think a lot of people don't realize that the NFL as a group has 31 teams involved in the Nike and merchandising deal, but the Cowboys have their own separate deal. How much does that account for the fact that they are number one on most valuable?
That certainly contributes to it. I think they'd be number one either way, but the gap might not be $800 million between the Cowboys and Patriots. But Jerry Jones went out on his own. He said, you know what? I can sell a lot more Cowboys stuff if I'm in control of everything. And you know, to his credit, it has worked out. He still has to contribute. The Cowboys were always the biggest seller. So the NFL, under terms of the separation, they demanded that the Cowboys continue to contribute a significant share into the pot. But it has absolutely been a home run to mix sports here analogies. And they generate tens of millions of dollars in profit from that merchandise business by running on his own. And he's expanded it beyond just Cowboys gear. He's doing merchandise for all sorts of sports entities. And so you have this economy of scale where it's not just the Cowboy business, but Jerry's also making money by producing other merchandise. And that's money that falls outside of money that has to be shared with other teams when you're talking about establishing a salary cap in the NFL.
In the number 12 spot, the Los Angeles Rams, the increase from 1 year to the next in terms of value 100%, is that just purely on St. Louis to the value of the Los Angeles market?
Mostly. I mean, we have every NFL team up just because teams are making so much money and it's such a good business. But absolutely, the Rams had the biggest gain year over year, went from outside the top 50 to number 12, as you say, worth $2.9 billion. And that is a function of trading the St. Louis market for Los Angeles. Stan Kroenke is going to build this sports and entertainment mecca out in L.A., spending 2.9 $3.6 billion. He's going to get some PSL money and a little bit a loan from the NFL, but he's footing the bill for the most part. And so their financial structure totally changes, going from a small market where they're hanging on. They're at the bottom of the league in revenue, down with the Raiders and Jacksonville and a few other teams. And they're going to catapult right to the top. They're not going to catch the Cowboys, maybe not the Patriots, but they should be a top five team in revenue, even with how terrible they are on the field. It is going to be a destination spot. The NFL is very excited about it. They're going to send a Super Bowl certainly there once the stadium's up and running. They're going to have all kinds of events there. They really look at it as almost a West Coast headquarters for the NFL with all the events that they want to run through there. So Stan Kroenke's got huge plans for that stadium, which is really going to be much more than just a stadium. It's going to be a huge sports and entertainment complex with which the stadium and then the whole area around it built up as well. He's a real estate guy, and he looks at this as really a real estate play.
Yeah, I know when I was out to broadcast the Rose Bowl, we went by Hollywood Park, and it was still an empty lot over there. But I guess when it's all said and done, he wants to turn this into, quote, a campus where NFL Network's going to be, NFL.com's going to be, plus the stadium and other entities, correct?
Yeah, it's going to be much more than just a stadium. And, you know, that money, again, that is generated from football events, that all flows to the Rams. But a lot of these guys, whether you're talking about the Rams, what the Patriots have done around Gillette Stadium with Patriots Place, the yep. Cowboys are always pushing the envelope in terms of generating revenue outside of the football team. And, again, that money doesn't flow to the NFL when they start calculating salary cap, but it obviously flows to the bottom line when you're talking about the Kraft family or Jerry Jones or with Stan Kroenke out in L.A.
Obviously, some people look at the value of a franchise, and I'm talking from the outside looking in without really understanding how value is calculated, and they'll see something like the New York Knicks being in the top 10, and the Knicks have done virtually nothing, as you and I both know, in the court for a while, and they see the Cleveland Cavaliers nowhere near the top 50 on this, and they've got LeBron James. So explain to everybody how that works out and why the value is so great for one that loses versus one that doesn't have the same value but wins.
Sure. Well, the Cavaliers are losing a lot of money. It's costing them a lot of money to win these championships. They've annihilated the luxury tax threshold in the NBA. But any buyer coming into this situation is looking forward. They're not looking at how awful the Knicks have been on the court over the last 10 years. That doesn't help the equation. If the Knicks were good, I think the value of the team would be even higher. But they're looking at revenue streams, and as bad as the Knicks have been, they still have the highest revenue in all of the NBA. That's without going to the playoffs. They considerably higher than the Cleveland Cavaliers because of the New York market. They're able to charge dramatically more for tickets, suites, sponsorships, you name it. The cost is higher in New York, and Knicks fans have continued to support the team and show up for games despite how bad the team has been on the court. And so as great as things are for Cleveland right now, you know, LeBron's not playing forever. We don't know if he's going to be in Cleveland beyond this year. So you're buying the team not knowing if you're getting, you know, one more year, five more years of LeBron. You know, best case scenario is maybe eight. But, you know, if you're investing in this team long term, you've got to look at the market. You got to look at the venue situation and not just your current roster of players.
I have to ask you about McGregor Mayweather because you wrote another very interesting article about that Mayweather now is a possibility with this fight with McGregor to go over $1 billion in career earnings. And as you point out in the article, Michael Jordan, Tiger Woods have done that. And if you adjust for inflation, you can put Arnold Palmer, Jack Nicklaus, and the race car driver Michael Schumacher in there. What are the dynamics of this fight and what can it mean earnings-wise on August 26th?
Yeah. It's hard to watch this and take it seriously, but people are clearly entertained.
I totally agree with you. I mean, I thought Pacquiao and Mayweather would be boxing's first no-hitter, and it lived up to my expectations.
Right. It's incredible. But it's hard to deny the entertainment factor. I think the whole press four-day, four-city press tour got up to be a bit much as they just rehashed the same tired lines. But, come August 26th, people are going to buy this fight. You know, for $100, people are going to get together and chop it up amongst themselves, and they're going to buy the money. Wouldn't surprise me at all if this thing broke the Mayweather-Pacquiao pay-per-view mark of $4.6 million. And if that's the case, Mayweather's looking at another, $250 million payday, which from is our estimate what he made once everything was counted and all the money. He's still collecting money from that fight because these guys take forever to report their pay-per-view results. So by our count, he made about $250 million from the Pacquiao fight, and he should receive a similar cut with this McGregor fight if it does that kind of pay-per-view business. So it all comes down to the pay-per-view number. Mayweather, he needs to bring it in because he flies out the window just as quickly with how he spends his money.
Right.
So it's... I think people will buy this thing, and it's going to do huge, huge business. By our count, total revenue for the Mayweather-Pacquiao fight was over $600 million, which at the time we'd never seen a $600 million night in sports. Not the Super Bowl, not any one night sporting event. It's a staggering sum of money to generate for 36 minutes of action. It should be entertaining. They've done an incredible job pulling this all together. I mean, if you think about Mayweather-Pacquiao dragged on for 6 years before it finally came to fruition. This thing they're putting together in a few months, and everybody's gonna make money. Outside of the fan, that is.
Right. Yeah, the fan won't. One final question, then I'll let you go, Kurt. Thanks a lot for the time. I really appreciate it. And that deals with the fact that there's UFC involved in this. What have you seen in growth of UFC? And obviously have been able to promote a great star like Ronda Rousey, who now has lost her last two, but McGregor's been a great star on the men's side. What has that meant to you to the payday, in your opinion?
For the UFC business, has been great. They build the business
$4 billion. With Mayweather, having the UFC component, having McGregor building his reputation in UFC.
Yeah, I think it's huge. I think bringing these two together is the only thing that could bring this kind of payday for Mayweather or McGregor. I mean, McGregor's looking at a minimum payout of $75 million. That's five times what he's ever made for a UFC fight. So, I mean, this is a totally different level. I think bringing these two audiences together gives it that potential to generate 4.5 million pay-per-view buys. Mayweather coming out of retirement to face anybody else, I mean, what would people pay? Who would they pay for him to see? Maybe what? Triple G? I mean, on the chance that he'd get knocked out, but Mayweather would never take that fight. So,
no.
I don't know who he could possibly fight in the boxing world that would generate anywhere close to this level of interest. So I think this was the one fight. And the novelty aspect of it, as much as the boxing experts totally dismiss the idea that McGregor can keep up with him, the novelty of it, and people pay up because they want to see somebody knock Mayweather out.
Yes.
I mean, that's why people keep buying his fights. They want to see somebody who's going to be the person that finally does it. And I think people have bought into the idea that that McGregor might be powerful enough, and he lands one punch and it's lights out for Mayweather. And that's why you'll see a lot of people pay for this fight.
He doesn't have a boxer's chance, but he has a puncher's chance.
That's a big right. Absolutely, okay. Steve.
Kurt, an absolute pleasure. Thanks so much. I appreciate the time very much, and hopefully we can tap into that knowledge even more so over time. The audience loved it.
Sounds good. Would love to. Thanks so much, Steve.
Kurt Badenhausen of Forbes intriguing, especially the last part there where you're talking about McGregor and Mayweather. The ticket sales on that so far have been slow, but you expect that. You would expect that the ticket sales on that will pick up with about, I don't know, a week to 10 days to go before the fight. And the bottom line is this. You have a lot of UFC fans out there. A lot of UFC fans. You have boxing fans out there. Plus, of course, Mayweather is the biggest name in boxing. He may not be the most popular guy, but he's the biggest name in boxing. And then you got McGregor, who has, of course, the UFC fan base. Flamboyant. And the bottom line is that you have the classic, the boxer, Mayweather, maybe one of the finest boxers, one of the finest defensive fighters ever, against a guy that with one punch could take him out. And that's what everybody's going to buy the fight about. The fact that they're going to see if there's that one punch. All right, second hour of the show coming up. Looking forward to it. Brought to you by Purdy Insurance on News Radio 1070 WKOK. When it comes to car buying, there's the other guy's way, and then there's the SMC way. The other guys force you into a vehicle you really don't want. The Subaru Motors way lets you take the time you need to browse, ask questions, and take the test drive and think on it. For over 100 years, the Mertz family and all their employees have made your experience the most pleasant one you'll ever have. The other guys won't offer you the best price for your trade, no matter how much they say they will. The SMC way is their promise to provide you with the most money the market shows your vehicle is worth. The SMC way is to offer you all applicable factory rebates on new vehicles and generous discounts. Looking for a pre-owned vehicle? The SMC Way checks each vehicle in a 200-mile radius to determine the lowest price, then beat it. It's the lowest price promise, just part of the SMC Way. The choice is up to you. The other guy's way or the SMC Way. The SMC Way wins every time. Sunbury Motors Company in the North 4th Street Auto Plaza, Sunbury, and at sunburymotors.com. Selling more cars and satisfying more customers for over 100 years.
Hi, this is Susan Purdy. For over 85 years, the Purdy Insurance Agency has been protecting families and businesses of the greater Susquehanna Valley and beyond. Our trained and knowledgeable staff has centuries of experience, so rest assured your needs will be evaluated and met by some of the industry's best representatives. No matter what your insurance needs are, call Purdy Insurance today at 286-5855, check us out online at purdyinsurance.com, or visit us on Facebook to see what we can do for you.
We are your home for the Philadelphia Phillies. News Radio 1070 WKOK Sunbury.